It's now my pleasure to welcome Associate Professor Susan Newhouse. Hello, Susan.
Hello, May. It's a pleasure to be here this afternoon.
For one so young, you have enjoyed a wonderful variety of experience. Tell us about what you're doing right now.
I guess just to look back, first of all, I've been very lucky in the opportunities that I've had. I suppose where I've landed is really a bit of a portfolio career, which is what I have at present, where I juggle a number of things, working in my day job as a surgeon, both in private and in public, and also being involved in research and in the not-for-profit sector as well. My primary job is as a surgeon, so my background is in general surgery and trauma surgery, but these days I work particularly in the area of what we call surgical oncology, which is dealing with cancers. So most of my days are spent dealing with melanoma and sarcoma.
Does that sometimes dishearten you?
And not so much dishearten. I think it has its own intrinsic challenges, but in many ways it is a great privilege to be able to work in that sort of world. I think there are lots of bad things that happen to people in life, and clearly a diagnosis of cancer is one of those. But inevitably there's always something positive that comes out of that journey, and being able to work with families and being able to work with people, and I guess trying to make their lives better, even if you can't necessarily change the outcome, is just an immense privilege.
Did you always want to be a surgeon?
I don't remember always wanting to be a surgeon. And in fact, I was asked the question the other day of how did I land where I've landed? And even when I look back, I'm not really sure how I've ended up where I am at the moment. I guess all I can say is that when I look back, I see these various steps and they all seem to have worked out the way they were meant to, that have led me to a place where I am now.
So you feel that fate had a hand in it?
I suspect so.
Tell us about some of these steps.
I joined the army as a medical student. I joined in my last few years of medical school. I'm still to this day not entirely sure what drove that decision, but I do sometimes say it was temporary insanity, but it was a very formative decision. So I finished my medical training here at the University of Adelaide and did my intern year here, and then went overseas to London to do some surgical training jobs, and then came back and worked in the full-time army for a number of years, and was very privileged to be picked up for particularly the overseas posting in 93, which was to Cambodia, which was absolutely a life-changing posting for me, to spend 12 months working with what was then our first major deployment since the Vietnam War. And I came back from that. I worked a number of different jobs, including at a helicopter base in Queensland, and then eventually decided that I really did want to do surgery. So in that time, I had to leave the army to be able to do that. So I left the full-time army, but carried on through the reserve and had what I guess could be considered a slightly schizophrenic existence for the next number of years, doing both surgery and also managing a bit of part-time army reserve career as well.
That sounds exhausting.
It sounds exhausting when you hear about it, but I don't think it was quite that exhausting at the time.
Why? Because your heart was in it?
I think, like anything, if you are passionate about what you're doing, it comes lightly to you. But I think also when you add things on paper, they always seem to take up more time than are possibly able to be achieved in a day. But the reality is that so many things overlap and intersect that in some ways they enable each other.
I gather, Susan, that you have two children.
I do. I have two beautiful girls.
How did you find the time to marry, have children, and do all of these things?
Well, I think life happens. I married to a beautiful man who used to be in the army, who was a helicopter pilot, and we do have two beautiful girls. I took time off after my first daughter. I was studying then, so I used that time to, I guess, profitable advantage. And then after my second daughter was born, I also took a little bit of time off as well and spent some time doing some things that I felt very passionate about.
You told me earlier that a man had once said that all a woman needed was a man and a good book. Is that right?
Not quite. The quote is actually from the Dean of the University of Sydney Medical School back around the turn of the century. And his advice to women who wanted to pursue a career in medicine at the time was that they would be far better served if they found a nice man and a nice frock.
Oh.
And my comment around that is, whilst that seems somewhat scandalous thing to say in this day and age, there perhaps is an element of truth in it, perhaps not quite in the way that the Dean intended, but I do think that for women who pursue a career and family, making a choice about your life partner and having someone who will enable you and is willing to support you through that journey and all of the flexible bits and negotiating bits that it requires to do that is probably profoundly important to people's success.
So the dean knew what he was talking about. He just didn't put it the right way. Is that right?
I suspect he probably didn't mean it that way.
What makes you think that?
Well, I think when you look back at the time and you look back at the consistency of the message that many of the early pioneer women in medicine received, it is a very solid and consistent message about really you're wasting your time. Why are you trying to do this? Your time would be better employed at home. We don't really want you here as part of the profession.
How did women who were treated in that way find their way into medicine?
I think that the early women were just absolutely remarkable, determined, single-minded women who clearly did not take no for an answer. And whenever an obstacle was placed in their way, they simply found a way around it or a way through it or a different pathway.
I understand that your book talks about some of these early women, doesn't it?
Yes, the book really came out of, I guess, a desire to share the narratives of some of these extraordinary women, particularly the early women who'd served as doctors in the army. These group of women, as I discovered their stories, I was just so blown away by what they had achieved and the circumstances around that. And I think it's very timely that as we're commemorating the centenary of Anzac and our minds are very much thinking around the tall, bronzed sons of Anzac, that we also remember that there were women there. There were women who served in uniform. There were women who served not in uniform but in volunteer roles. And, of course, there were women at the home front who took on enormous roles in supporting and enabling the war effort and, I guess, picking up the pieces when people came home afterwards.
That rings a bell. The ABC, they retold the story of the CWA, and when war broke out, the fact that they devoted their skills in handicraft to knitting multitudinous numbers of socks, as well as sending boxes of goodies over to the soldiers.
Well, it's funny that you mention knitting, because knitting is a bit of a theme in the book. The early women doctors who tried to enlist into the Australian Army were fairly singularly told that their efforts would be far better spent if they went home and improved their knitting skills.
And we have you in Cambodia in 1993. You came back from Cambodia. Where then did you go?
I came back from Cambodia and I also served then in Bougainville in 1997 and subsequently in Afghanistan in 2009. And I think it was really that deployment where I was prompted into starting to reflect on what it was to be a woman who was serving overseas, what that actually meant in terms of my role as a wife and a mother, and also to seek out some of the stories of the women who'd come before me. Because once I've discovered those, I've actually discovered that these women have done the most extraordinary things, particularly in World War One, that put my own experiences just really onto a back burner. I mean, just by way of example, if we look at Lillian Violet Cooper, who was a surgeon, she was working on the slopes of Serbia in Christmas before 1916 in an absolutely makeshift tent camp in the freezing cold, operating on missions, pulling out pieces of shrapnel, doing battlefield amputations, and making a real difference. And this was, for her absolute fulfilment of what she was doing as a surgeon. And yet, in Australia, we know very little about these women. We don't know the stories of, you know, the 15-plus women who went to the First World War and served in uniform. We don't really know the stories of those that have served in the Second World War. And although I think most people could probably name one of our VC winners, I doubt very much anyone could name the only woman that's ever received the Medal of Gallantry, which is Carol Vaughan Evans, a girl of my own age, who earned that during the massacre of Kibeho in Rwanda.
How long ago?
That was in 1997.
1997, and she's still not there in the history books for us to read about.
I think very, very few Australians would know of Carol's story.
Going back to the early women, not only did they put their expertise and their determination into place, But as I understand it from your book, some of them funded the work that they did.
That's right. Australian women got together and raised funds, as did women from the United States and women from the UK, in order to set up and fund their own hospitals. And that was because the so-called women problem of the First World War, you know, what did the military do with these non-nursing women that were extremely annoying and kept wanting to take on roles in the military when clearly they weren't wanted? So their answer to that was to set up their own hospitals. And the Scottish Women's Service, which was the first of those that was set up, went and set up their own hospitals in Paris and then subsequently in a number of places throughout the Western and the Eastern Front. They funded them themselves, they provided all the transport, all the logistics, they provided all the staff who were almost universally women, and they'd made an enormous contribution to the war effort. This was part of their ambition to say that we could do this, but it was also part of a political drive in England, certainly, because at that stage women didn't have the vote, and they believed very strongly that their efforts, by demonstrating that they could work and contribute just as hard as the men, that they would then post-war be entitled to have the right to vote.
So in a sense they were medical suffragettes, weren't they?
Absolutely, suffragettes in every sense of the word.
Only they didn't get themselves thrown into jail because they were too busy operating and helping.
They didn't get sent into jail, but they certainly were discriminated against in a number of other ways. For example, there was a hospital in London which was called Endell Street Hospital, staffed almost entirely by women. The women wore uniforms, they drew pay from the War Office, they had rank, but because they didn't receive official gazetted commissions, they were only entitled to travel on the trains in third class rather than with the other officers. They also meant that they didn't get entitlements such as veterans' entitlements post-war, and of course none of these women were entitled then to be considered as part of the Imperial War Honours lists.
I'm blown away.
Times have changed.
Such discrimination. Going back to 2009, you're in Afghanistan. What was the most common problem that you helped with as far as surgical intervention, medical intervention?
In Afghanistan, I was very fortunate to be working with a very small Australian team that provided the surgery and intensive care component into a Dutch-led multinational hospital in Tarin Kowt, which most people would recognise from the news as being where we had Australian soldiers based in Oruzgan province. Most of the patients that we saw in the hospital were children, often as the result of conflict, either directly as a result of improvised explosive devices or as a result of all of those other things that go with living and being in a conflict environment. We also, unfortunately, on one occasion had to deal with the after effects of a suicide bombing, which was at a police barracks where a gentleman had detonated earlier in the day. So it was a mixed variety. Some of the work that came through the door was clearly the result of malnutrition and chronic illness that comes with deprived societies, but very much focused on the large majority of our patients were children.
And at that time, your own children would have been four?
Quite little. I think they were either five and three or somewhere around that sort of age. So, yes, it was a bit of a challenge. And I think, again, one of the drivers behind trying to explore the stories of these women was the fact that I actually found it quite a number of things confronting. Not in a bad way, but just in a very challenging way. You know, what did it mean to be a female surgeon in what was a very patriarchal, male-dominated world dealing with Afghan men? You know, how did they see that? Did they think that was very strange? How did they reconcile that with their own views of what women did in society? And also, I guess, what did it mean for my daughters? How would they look at my service? Would they see that as something that was noble? Or would they see that as me going away and doing something that perhaps was looked at it through a more selfish lens of leaving the family? And how did that sort of relate with my sense of being a wife and a mother? So really that was kind of the lever that started opening this can that I subsequently have gone on and discovered so many other extraordinary women.
I think you're an extraordinary woman, Susan, I really do. And for the sake of our listeners, I must point out that you're not yet 50 years of age.
Not quite.
Tell us now about the writing of the book. Did you leave aside all of your other work and dedicate yourself to the book?
No, it was very much something that evolved over quite a number of years. Whenever I had time to do things, I would do more research. I travelled to Europe to find the battlefield hospitals on the Somme, which was quite exciting, and picnicked there, in fact, with my own family one afternoon. I spent enormous number of hours in archives and libraries and reading diary letters and so forth whenever I had the opportunity. But one of the key things that really happened in writing the book was when my path crossed with Sharon Mascoldea, who's an ex-BBC journalist. And Sharon really helped me to shape that story. And I guess more importantly, to deal with the issue of the contemporary women in the book, because I had found that quite problematic. I was absolutely determined that this book would not be my story. But at the same time, I had to recognise that the contemporary or the living women, many of them I knew, many of them I'd served with, and our lives had intersected in various ways. So it was very difficult for me to be completely objective about that. Sharon did the most beautiful job with interviewing each of those women. And I think certainly one of the standout interviews for me is the one about Tam Tran. And I'd known Tam. Tam and I had served very briefly in the same unit together. But it wasn't until Tam wrote to me as part of this project that I really realised that there was a much bigger backstory to her own experiences. And Tam had been a Vietnamese boat refugee, aged 10, when she came out to Australia. She didn't speak English. She was put into what we would perhaps now call a detention centre for a period of over 12 months, where she learnt English and subsequently went to school. She joined the army at the same time as I did and was a young officer and would have done her training very soon before I did mine, but then found herself in Iraq at the end of the First Gulf War, looking after the Kurdish refugees following the gassing attacks. And her interview is just so poignant when she reflects on her time as a refugee and also her opportunity to see really what that meant to a modern society.
Susan, it's absolutely amazing, the work that you've done, the life that you've led and are still leading, and I do congratulate you on your dedication to the world of medicine and to the role of women in medicine. I do urge our listeners also to go to their local library and say, "Not for Glory by Susan Newhouse is what I want." And I got it from my library by putting my foot down and saying it's got to come. I would like to say what a pleasure it has been to talk to you today and to congratulate you on your path so far.
Thank you, May. It's been a delight to be here this afternoon.